Well, thanks to Jonathan. He's doing his Miss Rabbit impression this morning and doing everything. So, well done, Sam. Great, let's have a look at the Bible together, shall we? And we're going to read from John chapter 15 in the New Testament this morning. Let me just get to the right place on this because this is wrong. F5, that's what we want. And as John's already mentioned, we're continuing our series, which looks at the Great Parks vision statement. What are we trying to do to people in this place? And I think John 15 is an important passage for us to get into. Just before we read the passage, though, let me say that if you've not been to the evening service for a bit, you're missing an interesting series. Well, at least I find it interesting, and it might be boring everybody else stiff, but this evening, this year, in the evenings, we're studying prophecy, just looking at the whole subject of prophecy in the Bible. And so far, we've been through the 12 minor prophets, and that took us the whole of January and February. Later on, we'll be talking about the big four. That starts next time, at the end of the month, next time down here. And we'll talk about Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and Daniel, the big four, because he had a lot to say, the longest books of prophecy that we've got. We've also got to fill in the autumn the book of Revelation and see how that fits in with the whole subject. But right now, we're just finishing a bit in March and April on prophecy and us today. And we've looked at three things under there. We looked at two, and the third is to come tonight. We talked about the whole subject of messianic prophecy. Did the prophets foretell Jesus and the gospel age and the church today? By looking back into those ancient scriptures, can we learn stuff that we need to know to Jesus and our relationship to him right now? And we looked at that first. Then second, we looked at the promises last week. Because the question here is, did the prophets of the Old Testament make promises that we need to know about and learn from? Certainly 2 Peter, a letter towards the end of the New Testament, is very, very emphatic on that subject, saying, listen, know these promises, build your life on these promises, stand on these promises, because that's what they're there for. So you're missing something out in your Christian life if you don't know the promises of God and how they fit in. Tonight, well, we're looking at the controversial one. Has prophecy ended? Or are there still prophets around in the church today? There's a lot of dissension about this in the church, isn't there? And right through the 20th century, there have been movements where people have said, yes, all of the spiritual gifts have come back. There are still prophets around today. And there are other people saying, no, prophecy was for another age. It's not for now. What can we make of all of that? We'll have a look at that subject tonight. So if you're interested, that's what's going on in the evenings. Anyway, let's talk about this morning. The vision statement for Great Park says four things. Our vision is to see people, first of all, saved, brought to a knowledge of Jesus in the first place. Second, disciple. Third, equipped to serve God. And fourth, encouraged by one another. And we've just been looking over the last few weeks at this whole subject of what it means to be a disciple of Jesus Christ. And we started by talking about the three responsibilities that were there in the ancient world. If you became the disciple of a rabbi, what did you have to do? And the three things were you had to learn to learn, to read the scriptures as the rabbi did, to follow his key to making sense of it, and to start on the process of learning that would go on through the whole the rest of your life. You were just learning how to learn, and the learning would go on forever after that. You also, though, had to learn to live in a certain way, the way that the rabbi taught and modeled, because a rabbi was no use if he just said, do this, don't do what I do, but just do this because this is the right way. No, he had to live it out himself and show that it was practical. And so by catching Jesus' style, by behaving like them, you become a disciple of Jesus too. Third responsibility, learning to love. Disciples lived in the community together. They learned to work out their relationships with one another. One of the big things about being a Christian, and we'll talk about that later on this morning, is the relationship of love that's supposed to be there in the family of God. So all of that we've talked about. We also started then talking about some of the conditions that Jesus made, because sometimes he uses the word disciple as well. And when he does, he's talking about certain things that have to happen if you're going to be one of his disciples. A couple of occasions ago, we talked about denying yourself. Jesus said, if you don't carry your cross and follow him, you can't be his disciple. What does it mean actually to deny yourself? We based the whole thing on those verses where Jesus uses those words and talked about that. The talk, obviously, is online on the church website if you missed it. We also talked last week about abiding in Jesus. And Jesus talked about that in John chapter 8 and verse 31. And we had a look at that last week. We said that the this version we were using, the Message version, said, if you stick with my living, with living this living out, I tell you, you are my disciples for sure. But stick with isn't necessarily the best translation. It's translated in lots of ways, but the traditional way is probably the best, which is abide. Make Jesus your home. Stay with him. Have him there with you. Recognize his presence day after day and every moment through the day. And we talked about some of the things last week that that means as well. But you know, there's one other thing that we've got to get in place, and that's the last two verses where Jesus talks about being a disciple and what you must do if you're going to be recognizable as a disciple. One of them comes out of what we were saying last week. If a person abides in me and I in him, he will bear much fruit. Apart from me, you can do nothing. Bearing fruit is part of the deal. But there's another one too. That's in John chapter 13, 35, and it says this, by this, everyone will know that you are my disciples. This is the one sure telltale sign, if you love one another. So that's one thing that's got to be there. Otherwise, your discipleship is sham, it's bogus, it just doesn't work. The second thing is what we just mentioned from John chapter 15, and that's the passage I want to read. This is to my Father's glory that you bear much fruit. And Jesus says, if you do that, you show yourselves to be my disciples. Two telltale signs. You love one another and you bear much fruit. So what he's saying really is real disciples produce results. Time to read the passage. Let's look at John chapter 15, shall we? And John 15 verse 1 says this. I am the true vine and my Father is the gardener. He cuts off every branch in me that bears no fruit, while every branch that does bear fruit, he prunes so that it will be even more fruitful. You, and he's talking to his disciples here just before he's arrested and crucified, you are already clean because of the word I have spoken to you. Remain in me and I will remain in you. No branch can bear fruit by itself. It must remain in the vine. Neither can you bear fruit unless you remain in me. I am the vine. You are the branches. If a man remains in me and I in him, he will bear much fruit. Apart from me, you can do nothing. If anyone does not remain in me, he's like a branch that's thrown away and withers. Such branches are picked up, thrown into the fire and burned. If you remain in me and my words remain in you, ask whatever you wish and it will be given you. This is to my Father's glory, that you bear much fruit, showing yourselves to be my disciples. As the Father has loved me, so have I loved you. Now remain in my love. If you obey my commands, you will remain in my love, just as I have obeyed my Father's commands and remain in his love. I have told you this so that my joy may be in you and so that your joy may be complete. My command is this, love each other as I have loved you. Greater love has no one than this, that he lay down his life for his friends. You are my friends if you do what I command. I no longer call you servants, because a servant does not know his master's business. Instead, I have called you friends, for everything that I learned from my Father, I have made known to you. You did not choose me, but I chose you and appointed you to go and bear fruit, fruit that will last. Then the Father will give you whatever you ask in my name. This is my command, love each other. Fruit and love. Two telltale signs. First question we have to ask about this then is, what exactly is fruit? And lots of people get this kind of picture when they look at it. A preacher preaching to an audience of folks who don't know Jesus yet and appealing to them to become Christians. Here's the end of a Billy Graham meeting where loads of people have come to the front to accept Christ for the first time. And sometimes people think about fruit in terms of people becoming Christians. When I was a student at university, before we did a mission, and there was a guy called Ed Rice from the Navigators, an incredibly effective teacher, who made us all in the Christian Union, and there were 500 of us, learn one verse from John chapter 15. I'll tell you what it was in a minute. And we had to learn that verse because it spoke about bearing fruit. And he said, this is what we're going to do. In your colleges, there are people who need Jesus. We're going to find them, we're going to bring them to Christ, and that will be the fruit of this mission. People have been gathering fruit in this way for many, many centuries. I found this quotation, which interested me, in Spurgeon's old magazine back from 1865. Many persons were moved to tears during this solemn service, and the deacons devoted 1 hour to personal conversation with those who remained behind. Mrs. Bartlett with her usual holy zeal, was occupied with a room full of trembling seekers. She's older than she looks, really, isn't she? There you go. But, you know, Christians have done this for years and years and years. But is that really what the New Testament means by fruit? It's an important thing to do. It's a vital thing to do. We support Stevie in his attempts to get other people involved in doing it, and that's brilliant. We should be doing that. But fruit, when you look at the way the New Testament uses the word, it's not talking about people coming to Christ. For example, Matthew chapter 3, verse 8, John the Baptist says, produce fruit in keeping with repentance. People have come to him wanting to be baptized, and he's saying, well, what's coming out of your life? If you're producing fruit that means I'm repentant, I'm sorry, I'm changing my ways, that's okay. But you're not producing that fruit yet. He goes on in Matthew 3:10 to say, every tree that does not produce good fruit will be cut down and thrown into the fire. It's the evidence of your life that matters. What comes out of your conduct, your behavior, your decisions, that's fruit. Jesus says the same in Matthew 7 in the Sermon on the Mount. By their fruit you will recognize them. Every good tree bears good fruit, but a bad tree bears bad fruit. In 12:33 he says, make a tree bad and its fruit will be bad, for a tree is recognized by its fruit. And again, he's talking about what comes out of people's lives. The whole impact of their identity on the rest of the world. That's fruit. It can be good or bad fruit, but you're making an impact on the world every day that you go around, and that is the fruit of your life. My Father cuts off every branch in me, he says in the chapter we've already read, that bears no fruit, and every branch that does bear fruit, he prunes. Romans chapter 7, you find Paul using the same picture. When we were in the realm of the flesh, he means before we were Christians, we bore fruit for death. And he goes on in the next verse to say, and now we're bearing fruit for life instead. The fruit of our life has changed now that Jesus got a handle on us. Hebrews chapter 13, let us continually offer to God a sacrifice of praise. And the writer of Hebrews says, this is what praise is. It's the fruit of lips that openly profess his name. If you go around talking about Jesus and identifying yourself with him, then praise flows naturally. It goes like fruit out of you. And you could go on. James chapter 3, the wisdom that comes from heaven is full of mercy and good fruit. You live your life with God's wisdom, and your life will produce all kinds of fruit. What fruit means really is everything that's there in your life that wouldn't be there if Jesus weren't there. The fruit that God wants to see from your life is something that comes naturally out of you because Jesus is giving you power and new life. He's the vine, you're the branch. His life flows into you. And just as a tree produces fruit without even thinking about it, so your life will do the same. So what does Jesus say about the fruit he's looking for? Let's just look at one or two of the things that Jesus says here in chapter 15. I want to mention just four of them. First of all, it's planned fruit. Second, it's much fruit. He says, you're going to bring much fruit. And that, incidentally, is the verse that Ed Rice made us all learn. You did not choose me, but I chose you and appointed you so that you will go and bear fruit and that your fruit will remain. And whoever bears much fruit bears it to my Father's glory, says Jesus. It's much fruit. Third, it's unspoiled fruit. Your fruit will remain, he says in verse 16. And that means it won't go bad. It won't spoil. You won't open the kitchen cupboard one day and say, oh, dear me, we should have thrown that out weeks ago. It doesn't happen that way. It's unspoiled fruit. And finally, it's his fruit, not ours. Because he says, separated from me, you can do nothing. Unless the life of the vine is flowing into you, you cannot live this way. You can keep up an act for a while, but you can't sustain it because you just don't have the energy, you don't have the power, you don't have the wisdom, you don't have the ability. It's only when I am there at the center of your life that this kind of life is possible. So let's look at those four things for a minute. First of all, planned fruit. Jesus said in that verse, you did not choose me, but I chose you. And I appointed you so that you might go bear fruit. Now, if you can remember as far back as our series on Romans, which was a while ago, I'll admit, back in 2022, we talked a lot about this, about the fact that, yes, we do choose Jesus. And that's why it's important for evangelistic fruit to happen in that way, that we challenge people to accept Jesus and to make a decision for him. And why the Mrs. Bartletts of this world spend time in the counselling room helping trembling souls to respond to the message. It's vitally important that we do that. But on the other hand, although we make a decision for Jesus, and it's important that we do, what we find when we've made that decision is that somehow, in the sovereignty of God, we're chosen by him as well. How come we choose him and he chooses us? That's one of those things that we don't understand. I'm not going to go back into all of that, though, this morning, or you won't get your lunch. So let's just leave it at that. But he chooses us. And so he says to his disciples, you did not choose me, but I chose you. And I appointed you so that you might go and bear fruit. Now, the word appointed is quite an interesting one, because it means to set in place. Like taking the last piece of the jigsaw and put, there it goes. Oh, you've done it. Putting something carefully down in the place it belongs. Jesus uses it about a candle. He says nobody sets in place a candle underneath a bucket. No, you put it on a candlestick and it gives light to the whole house. It's talked about Jesus' body. Come see the place where the Lord laid. Lord is laid. And the Lord was laid down with immense care by people who cared about him. They were really sad he was dead. They didn't just shove him into a hole and say, all right, that's Jesus with now. Have we got any more corpses to deal with? It wasn't like that. It was treated with immense care. And so it means deliberately putting in place. It's talked about in 1 Corinthians 12. Same words used. God has set in place apostles, prophets, pastors, teachers, all of that kind of stuff. People with gifts of healings, all kinds of different gifts that are mentioned in 1 Corinthians 12. God has put those things in the church deliberately for a purpose. That fits there. If I put that there, it will really do a good job. You've been set in place in just the same way. And so God has set you in place so that your life can bear fruit for him. Not so that you can coast through life clutching onto your little ticket to heaven, so that when the end comes you can go off onto a cloud somewhere, but so that here and now your life can produce fruit which will resound to the glory of God. That means the good things you do. That means the way you show consideration to others. That means the wisdom you show in helping people get their relationships straight. That means the way in which you become a byword for honesty in the place where you work. All of those things are part of the fruit of your life that should be coming out naturally without you forcing it. You don't have to get up in the morning, I must be honest, I must tell the truth, I must not pick my nose, I must do this, I must do... It's not like that. It's a matter of that fruit just naturally emerging. And Jesus says, the closer you stay to me, the more likely you are for the life of the vine to flow into you, the branch, and transform what you produce in life. So that's the thing, it's planned fruit. Jesus wants this to happen and put you in place wherever you are. Not just as some haphazard random arrangement, but because he knows that's the place he wants you to be to produce fruit for him. In your family relationships, in your work, in the school you go to, or whatever it happens to be, God wants your life to produce fruit. But he talks about much fruit. This fruit's pretty varied. Oh, you can see here are apples in this picture, but God wants fruit of different kinds from us. It's going to be not just one sort of fruit. You can't just be known for your patience, but on the other hand, be a little bit sort of, I don't know, lustful or greedy or whatever else. No, it's got to be one character that produces lots of different kinds of fruit. That's what the fruit of the Spirit is all about in Galatians 5. The fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace. It names 9 different things. And it's the fruit of the Spirit, not the fruit. You can't pick one kind of fruit and say, that's where I'll specialize, lemons but not bananas. You don't do that. All of those fruits or beaches of fruit are supposed to be there in your life. It's not just one sort. It not just happens in one place either. You can bear fruit in all sorts of different places, in the different connections of your life. You can bear fruit in places you've never been to by sending money. Christians who are trying to rebuild shattered lives in Gaza or Ukraine, or wherever it happens to be. You can pray for people you'll never see in your lifetime, but you can make a difference on the other side of the world. Fruit can be all over the place. It's not just one method either. It's not just one thing that you specialize in. And the more you go on as a Christian, the more you find that God will throw you out of your comfort zone into areas where you don't feel so specialized. You don't feel so confident. And God wants to use you there as well and use you to produce fruit in all sorts of places that you never imagined it to put you in. And so all of this is there. That much fruit means not just certain people. It's easy for us to like some people and not be so close to others, isn't it? There are some people who we just warm to and we want to help them. There are others whom it's very difficult to help. Just yesterday, I had a phone call from, well, a guy who is very difficult to help because he's very, very opinionated, and he's always laying down the law. Doing that yesterday as well, I had to grit my teeth most of the time. I was going, oh, John, that is stupid because, and so on and so forth. He's just like that. But he phoned me up because another friend, a friend of his, who is a complete narcissist, was having a health problem. It wasn't really a health problem. But the guy who phoned me up said, "Oh, I just wanted you to know that he's got this problem, and we may have to phone 999 and get him into hospital and all the rest of it, and I'm just going to put on my clothes and go down there." Because he's been ill, this guy. And I thought, the narcissist is so self-obsessed that he wants this guy to get out of bed and walk a mile down to his house, and the storm is just about to brew. So I said, "Listen, Joe, I'll be around in 5 minutes. Just wait until I get the car out, and I'll take you down to see the other guy." And I didn't really want to help either of them. One of them just is bossy and lays down the law all the time. The other one is just self-obsessed. Me, 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 me. And yet, you know, I had to do that. I really had to do that. So sometimes God will put us in situations where the people who need our help are not the lovely ones, not the ones we really want to help, not the ones we want to spend time with, but nonetheless, that's where the fruit's to be found as well. I'm not saying I'm a hero for doing that, just one example that came to mind. But also not just certain times. There's no limit on the way that God can use you. God can pitchfork you out of bed in the middle of the night to help somebody. "Oh, I just want to go back to bed." God can use you when you're just expecting a day off, and then suddenly the phone rings, and, "Oh, not again." But it's all producing fruit. And when God puts you into these situations where people need you and you can help, whatever way it is, and the fruit of your life is producing results that point people towards what Jesus calls my Father's glory. That's the important thing, isn't it? Third thing, it was unspoiled fruit. You remember? Unspoiled fruit. Jesus says, "You did not choose me. I chose you and appointed you so you might sow and bear fruit. Fruit that will last. It doesn't go off." Now, that's important too, isn't it? Because there are many of us who are super keen as Christian young people. And the more life goes on and we become burdened by work responsibilities and family responsibilities and all the different things to juggle and think about, the more our life gets narrowed down. And I know some very sour middle-aged Christians who have lost a lot of the spark that they once had. And you look back at what they used to do, and it was fantastic for God. Not in terms of the time they put in necessarily, but just the quality of it. And now you look at their life, and it's dried up, and it's cynical, and it's going nowhere. And it's almost as if the fruit has gone off. The life of the vine isn't flowing through anymore, and so it's past its sell-by date. And we mustn't allow that to happen. We need to be continually refreshed by the presence of Jesus in our life so that the fruit stays fresh. And what we produce doesn't become stale and boring and predictable, but expresses the life of Christ in new and incredible ways all the time. And you can tell somebody who's living that way. You see an older Christian whose life is still startling amazing people because constantly they're pulled in new directions. I remember two old people in our church, an old married couple who had never been in a pub in our life, not ever. And you know, we managed to persuade a pub in Newtown, the suburb of Exeter, where my church is, that we could go in and sing Christmas carols with some of the punters one Sunday afternoon. And he said, "Yeah, fine, okay, why not, come in and do it." And they were absolutely startled when we turned up and started singing carols, but they joined in, it was fine, they were drunk, so that's okay. And Ron and his wife came with us. They'd never been in a pub in their life. It'd always been a principle that we don't touch strong drink, it never passes our lips, and we wouldn't be seen in the license plate. That would ruin our witness and our testimony. And 5 minutes after they were in there, it was great to watch them because they were right at home. They were just chatting to people, gently sharing their faith, really at home in that environment. And I heard Ron say on the way, "I must come to a pub more often." Now, I'm not saying going to the pub is a great mark of spirituality, but you get the point I'm talking about, right? So, finally, it's his fruit. It's his fruit. And Scott Rodin is one of these guys in America who makes you exhausted just when you read the number of things he does. He's a preacher, he's a writer, he has a podcast, he runs several companies. He's just got one of those lives that's, you know, all over the place. And he used to try to do as much as possible to create an impressive bibliography to praise God. And then it worked out that really he was doing it the wrong way. And instead of demanding of me the driven life of trying to do good things for God, Jesus is inviting me into relationship with him that is so deep, so intimate, that my life will be filled with the Holy Spirit. As that Spirit works in and through me, my life will bear love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, gentleness, goodness, faithfulness, and self-control. All of the different kinds of the fruit of the Spirit. And he said, the impact of this fruit on the people we lead will result from what God is doing in us and through us, and not just from what we are doing for him. He said, this was a great discovery to my life. I could relax and let God do it through me. I didn't have to do the running. In fact, he says this, our drivenness for doing may be the single greatest obstacle to Spirit's work in us as leaders. We can become so busy working for God that we lose the depth of relationship with him that is required for him to work in us. When our work becomes our fruit, it carries no power to change or transform. Your work must not become your fruit. Your fruit is what God does in you, not what you work at for him. Your work should be produced by God's fruit in your life, but it's not the fruit itself. So, fruit is one sign that points to genuine discipleship. One other point to make and we're done. What's the other one? Well, do you remember we read two verses, and the other verse was about love. This was it. A new command I give you. Love one another. Something Jesus said earlier on the same night. As I have loved you, so you must love one another. By this, everyone will know that you are my disciples if you love one another. Now, if you were here in October 2022 and you've got amazing recall, you might think, I've seen that slide before. And yes, you're right, because we did talk about that in the Romans series once again. Because there's a verse in Romans chapter 12 where the Apostle Paul talks about the importance of love in the Christian life. And it's normally translated in a fairly sort of placid, middle-of-the-road way in modern translations. Love must be sincere, or something like that. What he actually says is, hey, agape, anipokritos. Three words, as terse and curt as you like. And what it means literally is, the love, not hypocritical. And he goes on from there with a little poem about what love looks like in action. And he says, you can fake love, you can try to anyway, but love for a Christian must not be hypocritical. It can't just be on the outside. That word hypokritos in Greek talked about the mask that an actor wore in the dramas in those days. You know, if you wanted to represent something sad and tragic, then give a big hint to the audience by coming on holding a mask in front of your face, which had a crying face. And if you wanted to show somebody happy, a big smiley face in front of you. And the actual actor behind the mask might have been feeling completely different that night. You might have a really happy face in front of you because that was the part you were playing, but it was only a part you were playing. And inside you felt miserable because your girlfriend had just dumped you. You just lost all your money. Your house had burned down. But you had to look happy because you were acting. That's not the way it is to be with us and our love, says Paul. Love must not be hypocritical. And when we talked about that in the Roman series, I mentioned something that Francis Schaeffer, the Christian philosopher, once wrote. Much shorter than most of his other books, but for my money, a lot more valuable than many of them. A little booklet called The Mark of the Christian. And it was talking just about that verse from John 13. They will know you are Christians by the way you love one another. He said this, the church is to be a loving church in a dying culture. How then is the dying culture going to consider us? Jesus says, by this all men shall know that you're my disciples, if you have love one to another, in the midst of the world, in the midst of our present dying culture. Jesus is giving a right to the world. Upon his authority, he gives the world the right to judge whether you and I are born again Christians on the basis of our observable love toward all Christians. The world will judge whether Jesus is real by the love we show to one another. I think that's important. Love is the mark of the Christian. And all too often, as you know, it doesn't work that way. Christians are not known around the world at this moment for their love. Mind you, the devil has made it that way because Christians are demonstrating love in all sorts of different ways on every continent in the world. And the trouble is the world just gets used to Christian initiatives, Christian relief organizations, Christian missions, all the kinds of things by which Christians show the love of Christ. Think, but they don't really love one another. But what they notice tends to be the disagreements, the angry websites, the public disputes in the press, the churches that close down because people fall out with one another and have splits, the way in which Christians just seem to pick fights with one another and stand on all sorts of different points of view. For example, tonight we're talking about, are there prophets in the present day? Whoa, my goodness. We have cessationists, we have continuationists, we have concentric continuations. We've got all sorts of different things, and people who've got different opinions on the subject divide themselves off from other people. You look at prophecy. Are you premillennialist? Are you a postmillennialist? Are you an amillennialist? Are you a historic premillennialist or a dispensational premillennialist? Because there's a big difference. Do you believe in the pro-wrath theory? Oh, but that means that you're that you have certain views about the great tribulation. Are you a post-tribulationist or a mid-tribulationist or a partial tribulationist or serious tribulationist or an a-tribulationist? So you don't believe it? You can't talk to a-tribulationists. They don't believe anything. You know, and we do that, don't we? We divide everything up so small because it pushes other Christians away from us. It said in the church today there are something like 180,000 different denominations. That part of that's cultural. Part of it, too, is just human pride and arrogance cutting off from other. So, final question. Why do Christians find it so difficult? Here you've got two Christians in action extending the right hand of fellowship to one another, curled up into a fist. And the guy with the big Bible bag taking a flying leap at the other one. Why do we find it so difficult to show love to one another? I think there are lots of reasons, and we need to be aware of them, because it can affect us and the way we relate to other Christians too. First of all, there's the internal reason. We are sinners. Pride and arrogance and self-seeking are part of our makeup. And unless we let that new life of Jesus transform our relationships, so that we reach over the natural boundaries that we feel from other people and see them as people and brothers and sisters and people for whom Christ died, then we're going nowhere. But when we do that, then the world sees a miracle happen as people who are so different from one another start to accept one another and stand together as family. So there's the internal reason. There's also the relational reason. The relational reason is just that if we are sinners, so are other people. And they will do us down. They do nasty things to us that take a lot of forgiving. Just this week in a bookshop, I found a copy of a book by David Augsburger. I read one of his books a few years ago called Caring Enough to Confront, which is about how sometimes if you really care about other people, you've got to stand up to them. And it's an absolutely brilliant pastoral book. This one was about caring enough to forgive. And I found it much more challenging when I look at it. Because I began to realize just how much is involved in forgiveness and how much our nature rebels against it. I will never speak to him again. I cannot forgive those people. They have let me down. Or perhaps we don't talk like that because, well, you know, Christians are supposed to forgive, but we just ignore them. We cut them out of our lives. We have no contact with them. And officially we've forgiven them, but actually in our minds, we're living the past, reliving the past again and again and again. So you've got those reasons. Third, there are personal reasons. We've got likes and dislikes. There are some Christians with whom you get on very well. There are others that you probably can't stand. And unless Jesus changes you, it's going to stay that way. I remember finding out about that very dramatically once when I was a student. And I went on an ON mission. You know, they send people to exotic places in Operation Mobilization. You go to the ends of the earth and Persia and Afghanistan and Africa and also I went to Swindon. But anyhow, in Swindon they made me a team leader, and there was just one girl on that team whom I could not stand. I really could not. It was nothing big either. It was just her voice grated on me. She was very sentimental, and I do not like sentimental people. You know, and I just for some reason, I remember praying to God the first night and the second night I was there, saying, God, if you don't do something in me, I'm not going to make it through a week without doing something to that girl. It's very unfortunate indeed. And you know what? He changed me. And she became a very respected friend, somebody whom I really cherished. And over the course of the next few days, I had to grit my teeth. I had to work at it. What God said to me basically was, you do loving things towards her, and I'll take care of the emotions. And so I treated her as if I did care for her. And after 3 or 4 days, you know what? I care for her, all right. She's okay. And God had just changed me and melted the natural barrier. And sometimes we need him to do that. Then there are societal reasons. We're living in a world which is more and more fragmented. Relationships are more and more difficult. And we need to realize that. I've got a wee book in my bag there. I was going to quote from it, but there's no time this morning. It's called Refrigerator Rights. It's a Christian book, the fact that there are fewer and fewer people in our work life who have refrigerator rights. By that, the author means people who can just march into our house, open the fridge, and help themselves to a sandwich. Maybe this is American or something, because there aren't many people that I would allow to do that. But anyhow, that's the idea. There aren't many people that you get really close to anymore, because the world pushes us away. And social media, instead of connecting, actually separates us. And sometimes, because of our culture, we feel closer to the people we see on daytime television or Coronation Street or something like that than real people that we actually have to deal with in real life. We're living in an artificial environment, and real relationships are harder and harder for people to achieve. And finally, there are spiritual reasons. The devil doesn't like it when Christians get too close, because that love between Christians speaks about God's glory at work in us, doing things that nothing else can do to break down barriers and fuse together a new, beautiful family. And so the devil will do whatever he can to make misunderstandings arise, to tempt us with all the wrong instincts so that we do split away from one another. And he's very, very successful in some parts of the church right now, isn't he? But Jesus says those are two of the telltale traits of discipleship. One, you bear fruit. Two, you love one another. If you do that, people will know you're my disciples. So, finally, in my last minute, where are you in all this? Where does this leave you? Once upon a time, I saw an advert for some fruit trees, and we have a patio outside our back door, and, you know, space either side. I thought it'd be great to have some fruit trees growing up either side of it. I don't know what to do with the third one, but hey, there's an apple tree, and there's a pear tree, and a cherry tree there. I thought, this is great. We'll get them, we'll put them in. They will produce fruit, and it'll look lovely in our garden. This, in fact, is the reality. That's what it looked like yesterday. Okay, I could have taken better care of it. But at the same time, I tried really hard. I put it in a pot where it was well prepared for it. I did all the things to, you know, make sure there was plenty of drainage and so on. It's never produced anything. Basically, they sold me three bits of stick, I think. Now, I'm not a great gardener, so, you know, I may be wrong there. But that's what can happen, isn't it? Something that's supposed to produce a lot of fruit just doesn't. And Jesus must look at some Christian lives and think, that's not what I expected. That's not what it should look like. There are other things in my garden that do grow quite well. I've got nothing to do with that, I've got to say. Anthony's got a fair bit to do with it, but not me. But this one was actually there before we arrived. It's not fruit, but this is a hydrangea. It just keeps on growing. And if you look at that picture closely, you can see where Anthony's been vainly trying to hack it back and stop it spreading all over the world. But this hydrangea has a mind of its own, and it's taking over the planet. It's unbelievable. And already this year, as you can see, it started to spread all along the fence. It just keeps on growing and growing and growing. And that, more than my fruit tree, is a picture of what Jesus wants from our lives. So when you look at your life, and all the fruit that's coming out of it, what does it look like? When you look especially at that fruit of love with other Christians, how are you doing on that one? Because that determines whether the world will look at you or not and say, yep, that is a disciple. Let's sing our last song together, shall we? It's Lord, for the years your love has kept.